Can you hear me? So good morning, everyone. My name is Herman Lee from JAXA, Japan. And first of all, many thanks for the organizers for the invitation to this very beautiful place. So today I'm going to talk about broadband emission models for SNLs from young to middle age. I'm going to give a very broad overview on the current situations of broadband modeling, the methodology, the capabilities, and the limitations of the state-of-the-art broadband models for SNLs. So first of all, I will start my talk by saying that the life being a broadband emission modeling modeler today is not so easy because broadband modelers must satisfy many, many constraints from observations. So we have to satisfy the multi-wavelength spectra from radio or the radio TV energies, the very detailed structures observed by multi-wavelength observation of the morphology, the time evolution, dynamical informations, thermal as well as thermal properties, and all the different combos of the above, like the spectral images and spectral evolution, etc. And also the model have to meet the criteria coming from the complex, very complex correlationist plasma physics and the first principle kinetic simulations. So stemming from the yet incomplete physical understandings of many processes, this reflects in the few numbers of parameters still existing in the broadband emission models. And sometimes we have to rely on approximations to work around very complex processes, either to reduce computational costs, or just in a case where the processes are too complex, we cannot actually implement into a broadband emission model easily, other than first principle kinetic simulations. So these are the common ingredients of the broadband emission models nowadays. First of all, we have hydrodynamics or MHD, and then we will have some kind of model for the progenitor, a supernova explosive nuclear synthesis model to as the initial conditions for models. And we will have a picture for the surrounding environment, either it's a stellar wind or a molecular cloud, and these are motivated by observations in radio and etc. And usually models have various kinds of implementations of diffusive shock acceleration. And then we will have a whole bunch of time and space dependent microphysical processes we have to take into account in the model in order to confront multi-wavelength observations like ionization, charge exchange, shock heating, temperature equilibration for the temperature of the electron and ions, and radiative cooling heating in the case where the shock is running into some molecular cloud and the shock becomes radiative or the SNL is very old. And then the all-important particle-wave interaction and the generation of magnetic turbulence and dissipation and then feedback to the particle acceleration. And after accounting all these processes, we can start to calculate the thermal and non-thermal emission and confront multi-wavelength data. So this is kind of a summary of the current numerical approaches for studying SNLs. We have particle and cell simulation, which is going to be introduced by Anatoly later in today, and also hybrid simulations. These simulations are based on first principle physics. They have virtually no parameters, and they can actually give us very deep insights into the physical processes happening around correlational shocks. But they have very heavy computational costs, and still nowadays they have limited dynamical ranges, so they are still a bit difficult to be used for multi-wavelength modeling. On the other hand, we have a Monte Carlo simulation or semi-analytic approaches for particle simulation, particle acceleration, etc., and also global hydrodynamical simulation with microphysics. These models usually have more phenomenological approach to plasma physics in the form of parameters, but they have a much larger dynamical ranges, and we can constrain these parameters by using extensively multi-wavelength observation data. So nowadays, broadband emission models for SNL is based on this category, a combination between semi-analytic and global hydrosimulation, a coupling between these two. So this all you know all of this already, but just let me go through it very quickly. Components of SNL. So you outside of SNL, you have interstellar medium or some stellar wind. In the middle, you have some coal and shot ejector material or dust. In between, you have a very hot shot plasma, which can emit very strong X-ray emissions. And in between these regions, we have the forward shot and reverse shot. And in the middle, we have contact discontinuity. And sometimes, for some SNRs, they're interacting with some dense material, like atomic clouds or molecular clouds, which can be revealed by a radio observation like here. This is an Arcali image of Tycho in infrared, and this is CO observations, which is delineate the distribution of molecular cloud around Tycho. And correspondingly, we also see all sorts of emission in multi-wavelength from SNR. We have infrared emission from hot dust. Brian has given us a very good introduction earlier in the meeting. And some X-ray emission from the very hot plasma, either from the shock ejector material or shock circumstellar medium. And this, you can see this very beautiful blue room here. It's a thermal X-ray emission coming from ultraviolet typical electrons emitting synchrotron radiations. This is thought to be one of the first evidence for particle acceleration going on in supernova remnants. And also, we have at lower energies, we have optical and infrared emission in light form, like H-alpha emission and radiative shocks. At the same time, we also have radio emission, which is basically also synchrotron radiation, but coming from a much lower energy electrons, multi-relativistic. And they can have very different morphological properties than X-ray emissions. At the same time, thanks to the Fermi gamma ray telescope and also a ground-based Sorrento telescope, we have started to discover many gamma ray emitting SNRs. And this is kind of like evidence that the SNR is actually accelerating particles, and give us evidence that the SNRs are actually very promising origin for the cosmic rays in galaxies. So this you have seen this plot many times. It's in this meeting already. So SNRs are thought to be the origin of cosmic rays in galaxies based on very, very simple energetic arguments like this. So from theories and observations, we know that SNRs can easily convert the bulk kinetic energy from a shock into a cosmic ray to at about 10% level. And if galaxies have a supernova rays around this value, it seems that this is sufficient to explain the energy contents observed in the cosmic rays near their solar system. So this is, again, the total particle cosmic spectrum. And you see some features here. So there's the need where people believe that we know the need, the cosmic is coming from galactic sources, like supernova remnants. And about that is from an extragalactic origin. Most of the cosmic rays are actually find the lower energy range. And although the cosmic can go to very, very high energies, these cosmic rays are very, very few in number. Like the detection rate is about 1 per kilometer square per year, very, very few. And also about the maximum energy that SNR can accelerate particles to, this is a very rough argument using the Hilhurst diagram. The size of the cosmic accelerators controls the maximum energies that of the particles that a cosmic accelerator can accelerate. So SNRs is somewhere around here. This is size and a B field. And according to this diagram, SNRs can accelerate particles roughly to about a PeV energies. So all of this seems to be consistent that SNRs can be the origin of cosmic rays, at least being known to need. But still, we have puzzles remaining to be answered. Like we still lack a smoking gun evidence that SNRs can accelerate cosmic to perpetrons from observations. We still miss smoking gun evidence. And also, our understanding of the acceleration mechanism of cosmic rays is still incomplete, especially in the details of particle-wave interactions. And how those cosmic escape from the source to become galactic cosmic rays is still incompletely understood. And the elemental composition of different energies, while different ions have different spectrum in the cosmic spectrum we observe at Earth, is not fully understood. And also in the bigger picture, how do we understand SNL as the whole populations? How do we understand the variety of SNLs, the different evolution stage, and how to understand diversity of environments that surround SNLs? It's also we need the understanding in the bigger picture. But bad news is that we cannot answer this question by simply doing cosmic ray astronomy. This ain't gonna work because whenever particles is injected into the, from the accelerators, they get banned by the electromagnetic field like crazy. And once they reach the our solar system, we will lose their directional information from the original source. So we cannot rely on cosmic astronomy to study the physics from these cosmic accelerators. But the good news is that we have alternatives, because these accelerators are known to emit multi-wavelength emissions, and we can rely on this emission to infer indirectly the information and physics at the, at the accelerators. And the good thing is that the lights don't bend by the cosmic magnetic fields, so they point directly towards the cosmic accelerators. So the one of the most useful lights that we can use to infer information is the gamma rays, because they are mostly non-thermal. This is one example for Vela Jr. This is a broadband model we have done some years ago with Pasling et al. This is a leptonic model, hadronic models. In the case of leptonic model, the gamma rays is dominated by so-called inverse Compton emission, which is produced by very high energy electrons interacting with local photon fields like CMB. And we have signature emissions. We have pi zero emissions, which is coming from the cosmic ray protons or ions interacting with the local gas that can subsequently produce neutral pions and then decay into the gamma rays. And of course, we have the beam strontium. And this light here, which just looks very funky here, is the thermal X-ray emissions. So in the case of pi zero decay, usually the spectrum is very flat and requires a very dense gas to act as a target for the protons to interact with to produce neutral pions. And also on the case of inverse Compton scattering, usually the spectrum is very hard and we require low B field to suppress the singleton loss, as Steve have already mentioned earlier in his talk. And we also need the low density to suppress the contribution from pi zero decay. And in the case of non-thermal strontium, we also need the dense gas as a target, and sometimes we need a high so-called electron-to-proton ratio to suppress the contribution from pi zero. Just a word of caution here. Sometimes people misunderstand that leptonic model means there's no proton acceleration, but it's simply not true. Whenever we are SNL emit gamma rays in the leptonic channel, it simply means that there's no target or dense gas for the protons to interact with to produce neutral pions. Actually, theories requires that both protons and electrons be accelerated by the correlation shocks, because we need the protons to generate and amplify the magnetic turbulence. So this is just a repetition of what Elena has already gave us a very comprehensive overview on the general ideas of a diffusive shock acceleration. So I will just go through it very quickly. SNL is a very strong non-bare diffusive shocks. That means that the so-called Fermi first order acceleration or diffusive shock acceleration should take place. So the idea is very simple. Particles kind of diffused by elastic scattering with some sort of magnetic turbulence on both sides of the shock like this. So the particle changed the pitch angle by interacting with magnetic turbulence and then change the direction. And higher momentum particles can diffuse farther away from the shock. Lower momentum particles only will stay near the shock because of the energy dependence of the diffusion coefficient. And all these particles have a finite probability to cause a shock repeatedly. And each time they cause a shock, they gain a fractional momentum gain, which is proportional to the velocity difference between the upstream and downstream divided by the speed of light. What is this? Sorry about that. So from theory, we know that cosmic ray energy energy can easily goes up to about 10% of the total kinetic energy of the supernova, according to theory. And for strong shock, we have already know that the convection ratio of a shock should approach 4 in the case of test particle acceleration. But usually the situation is not that simple, because in many times particle acceleration can be very efficient, and we cannot ignore the effect of the cosmic ray that can affect the shock structure itself. And in this case, we have to consider so-called nonlinear diffusive shock acceleration, where the cosmic streaming up, ahead of a shot in the precursor would exert a considerable pressure onto the incoming gas and change the structure of the shock. And on the other hand, the changed shock structure will also feedback to the particle acceleration itself. That's why we call it nonlinear. And I will not go into details here, but basically we have three major impact from the nonlinear diffusive shock acceleration. First of all, we have a very highly modified shock flow. And also we have a concave spectrum in the cosmic wire than a simple power law. And we have a lower shock temperature compared to a simple German condition, because much of the energy can be channeled into the cosmic rays rather than hitting the gas behind the shock. And this has a profound implication on the thermal X-ray emission, for example. So from this slide on, I will try to use my code to demonstrate how a broadband emission model works in the modern age. Our code is called CL Hydro NEI code. So what it includes is, first of all, nonlinear DSA physics, which includes the black pressure effect, which can feedback to the shock structure, and vice versa. Broadband emission models also include the effects of a particle escape from the far to the upstream, and some kind of implementation to calculate the generation and damping of the magnetic turbulence, which are the agents for actually mediate the process of Fermi acceleration. Usually, from observations and theory and simulation, we also often see cases that the magnetic field actually can be amplified by shock to a very high value, much higher than the simple compressed B field in the microgauss level. And by using this B field, we can calculate the diffusion coefficient. That is a very important component to calculate particle acceleration. And then a model would calculate the non-thermal broadband emission in space and time and energy. And usually it's also found to be very useful if you can calculate the thermal X-ray light emissions self-consistently with the non-thermal emission at the same time. So this requires that the code has to calculate the non-equilibrium ionization with ionization recombinations using the latest atomic data, and also some sort of model for the temperature equilibration. The physics is still very poorly understood, has been introduced by Pavis yesterday. We require some model to determine the electron temperature and the ion temperature in the downstream in order to calculate the X-ray light emissions. Also, some sort of implementation that can calculate the propagation of escaping cosmic rays. So in case there's a molecular cloud in the upstream, this escaping cosmic can interact with the clouds to produce TeV gamma rays. Thank you. And reacceleration of pre-existing particles and fast radiative shocks in some cases, and also to, linking with the supernova nuclear synthesis model to give us the initial condition for the ejector. So not only the broadband model has to take into account this physics, they have to take into account this physics self-consistently in a coherent framework, and then produce all sorts of outputs that can be directly compared with observations. So this kind of code work in mostly work in an iterative workflow. First, we start with initial conditions, like the distribution of the chemical elements in the ejector, fit to the code, calculate the particle acceleration, etc., and then compare with the observation. If we don't get a good fit, then go back to the initial condition again. So the first step is, of course, to get the size right. Otherwise, we are looking at a different remnant. For example, we can change the ambient density, change the particle acceleration efficiency, distance, etc., until we get a model that is broadly agreed with the observed size and the expansion rate for a particular SNR. And then we can look at the all-important non-thermal spectrum. This is a case we have shown already in the earlier for Vela Jr., radio, X-ray, GV, and TV energies for different components. Usually what people do is to find parameters that will give you an electronic model, and a hadronic model, and then look at the parameters to see whether they make sense or not. But in some cases, actually, by fitting to the non-thermal spectrum, does not give us very firm conclusion, because as you can see in this case, both models can fit the data pretty well. So what we should do is to look at other kinds of data that will help us to break this degeneracy. For example, we can look at the profiles of the brightness. This is a case of Tycho. Like in the radio and the X-ray energies, and also in the gamma energies, you can see in our model we can fit the X-ray pretty well just by invoking very high amplified B field, and the electron loses energy very quickly, and we can explain the X-ray profile very well. But in the radio, we can only, in this particular model, we can only explain the diffuse part of the radio. We can fail to explain the radio filaments, as already introduced by Steve earlier. This will require some kind of implementation for the damping of the magnetic field behind the shock. And also, one step further, we can use the spectral images by looking at the spectral properties at the different specific region of interest. Like we can look at the ROI specific spectrum and then compare with the model by doing a line of sight projection. And also look at the spatial variations of the spectral index. In this case, it's for phylogenia, and it seems that data supports the leptonic model, which means that the B field is very low, like in the microgauss level. And one thing I would stress is that the thermal X-ray is also a very important component to constrain the origin of gamma rays, because in SNR, thermal X-ray emission are coupled to broadband emissions. So we cannot just fix the non-thermal emission and change, play around with the thermal lines. They are coupled to each other. So this is very important, because in some cases, when we calculate both the non-thermal and thermal emissions subconsistently, we can find evidence that one model is more consistent than the other. For example, this X-ray observation by Oscar. This is a leptonic model, hadronic model, and the hadronic model requires very high gas density. But this, because the thermal emission is scaled with density like square, so in some cases the thermal emission would be overpredicted against the data, and we can conclude that one model is better than the other, something like that. And this is very important, because the leptonic model and hadronic model usually predicts very different energetics for the cosmic rays. I will skip this because my time is running out. And also, we can calculate the detailed thermal emissions by coupling our code with CFDR, the ejector model from supernova nucleosynthesis models, and also latest atomic data. This is one example where we may not see the lights here, very thin lights here. The thin lights are the thermal spectrum, and the solid light is the same thermal spectrum after thermal broadening. So we can calculate the individual parameters of different ions to predict the thermal broadened profile of the lines. This is very useful for future X-ray spectroscopy, when we can achieve a high resolution. So thermal broadening is also very important to infer information for the progenitor or incubation physics or particle accelerator physics. But my time is running out, so I'm going to skip that. Maybe you can look at the slide later on. So I will go very quickly to the next topic on the bright radio and gamma emission from middle-aged supernova remnants, which has already been covered by Roger and Sharping very early on in this meeting, and this is my take. So we know that according to Fermi, many of the middle-aged supernova remnants are very bright GeV gamma ray emitters. They are interacting with molecular clouds, and they are also very bright in radio. So we try to create a model that can explain both this kind of bright non-thermal emission from these otherwise dynamically evolved supernova remnants. So we know that now we have smoking gun evidence from this Fermi spectrum that this gamma ray emission is coming from pi zero decay, because we have a characteristic low energy cutoff here. But the many puzzles still remain, like how do this middle-aged supernova remnant can accelerate so much cosmic protons? And how do we explain their spectral properties? So we use a so-called cloud scenario, where a forward shock runs into a molecular cloud and drive a cloud shock into the cloud. The cloud would evolve in a very high density medium and eventually becomes radiative. And once they become radiative, a cold dense shell will form behind the decelerating cloud shock. And gas, B field, and cosmic rays can be rapidly compressed inside the radiative shell, and as a result, bright gamma rays and bright radio emission can be produced. So we have constructed a model with Dan Pagnol, John Raymond et al. To construct hydrodynamical simulation with detailed microphysics to test this crush cow scenario. Also see Tan and Cervelli, which is have a very similar idea. Basically, run a radiative shock hydrodynamics with full NEI and also a reacceleration scenario for the cosmic rays. So we calculate the cooling of gas, heating of gas due to the photoionization and thermal conduction. And this is kind of the movie. That's it. Okay. Go back. One second. So this is basically time evolution of the hydro variables as a function of time in the short rest frame, temperature density, B field, and velocity. You see the gas starts to cool down because of becomes a radiative shock, and a very dense shell is formed. B field gets compressed. If we look at the broadband emission spectrum at the same time, we see that when the shock becomes radiative, both the radio and GV gamma rays can suddenly be enhanced by orders of magnitude because of compression. This is just the evolution of a flux. And this is the same thing. We look at the radio and the GV spectrum. We see that this kind of scenario can explain the data, for example, from WF44 very well. So in the last part of my talk, how much time do I have left? How much time do I have left? Excuse me, how much time do I have left for the talk?
1 minute,
okay. I will finish. So I was planning to talk about the connection between supernova simulation and supernova remnant simulation, but I only have 1 minute left. So luckily, I have my friend Dan Pagnol, who will give a talk on this very extensively tomorrow. So please stay tuned. So I will skip all this. He will talk about that. And just to give you my version for the vision for the future of our supernova remnant researchers, it's kind of my personal roadmap. So we have to strive to achieve a deeper understanding of supernova remnants, including understanding the origin of cosmic rays, how they generate the magnetic turbulence in the universe, understanding of the complex physics of astrophysical plasma and short waves, and how do SNRs impact their surrounding environment in the interstellar space of galaxies. And also, at the same time, another committee is working very hard towards a true picture of supernova explosions, including understanding the nature of progenitor star remnants, the explosion mechanisms, and the nuclear synthesis of chemical elements, which is essential to the dawn of life, and how do they transit, thank you, to the SNR and interstellar medium. And eventually, we have to link this together, because this is basically the initial condition of this. So we cannot ignore each other. Better communication between these two committees is very, very crucial. And after this, we can start to interpret the multi-wavelength data with state-of-the-art models. And we have visions from a future telescope, which is going to give a very high-quality data all across the electromagnetic spectrum. And this is my conclusion. So we have reviewed on the general methodology and capabilities of modern broadband emission models for SNRs. And there are still some current limitations coming from incompletely understood physics, and that reflects into a few numbers of parameters and models. We have to rely on rich observational data and breakthroughs from first principle kinetic simulations to constrain or remove these parameters. And I've stressed the importance of collecting progenitors, supernova, and remnant, and this requires a very close joint efforts of the communities to combine state-of-the-art models in each area for a self-consistent full picture for the latest stage of stellar evolution. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Herman, for excellent talk. I didn't sleep, you know, I was just reading your slides. All right, we have a time for a few questions.
Hi, Fabrice.
Hi, very good.
Very good work.
The question I had was, could you tell us what you assume for the initial equilibration in your
model? So our model, the simplest case is to assume a two-extreme case. The slowest possible is a Coulomb interaction, and the fastest possible is an instantaneous incubation between all the species. And somewhere, of course, the reality would be somewhere in between. But usually, the way we work on is to first look at this two extreme case, how this would have, if we calculate the X-ray spectrum for these two cases, and see the differences, and compare with data to see how actually the situation is. Yes, very, very important.
Okay, what about if it involves the time from low acceleration to high and the shock goes slower?
Yes, we have to look at this in the future. But currently, we don't see stay with either the Coulomb interaction or the instantaneous equilibrations.
So my question was, if your shock slows down with time, going from like 5,000 down to 1,000 down to 500, if you vary the amount of initial equilibration at the shock front as it's getting older, have you tried doing that, actually making it drop or increase with time? Mm-hmm. Have you actually considered that?
Yeah. So you can see the impact of using a Coulomb and an instantaneous equilibration of the X-ray spectrum here. So quite a big difference. Well, it depends on the environment, of course.
This is really nice work. I've always liked this type of modeling, and you guys are doing a great job.
Thank you very much.
Can you give us an idea of the computational cost of your calculation? So for a typical case, how many parameter can you vary, and how long do the model sort of take to run?
The computational cost is close to none. So one model like this would take about 2 or 3 hours. Depends on how much spatial resolution you want, but basically 2 or 3 hours is enough. Parameter-wise, we have about 4 important parameters plus other minor parameters, but we can use all the diversity of observation reporters to constrain the parameters to avoid degeneracy of our models.
Nice talk.
Thank you.
Are your calculations fully three-dimensional or 1D?
The slide I'll show you is 1D, but we are also starting to develop a 3D versions.
Because actually, I mean, if you want to take into account any effect of anisotropies or interaction with an inhomogeneous medium, you should move to 3D.
Yeah, I completely agree. My personal opinion is that both 1D and 3D simulation has to be performs together at the same time.
In that case, the computational cost will be very, very high in 3D.
In the 3D case, yes. Yeah. So maybe the best approach is to first do the 1D simulation to get a basic idea of what is going on in the environment. And then once we get a good idea, we go on to a more detailed 3D simulation where we can start to look at very detailed structures and the compare with the observations. Otherwise, it's very hard to understand, the comparison.
Evolution can be also a very crucial ingredient for the comparison with the observations.
Yes.
So that's why we are doing simulations in three dimensions to link the properties of the supernova explosion with the final morphology of the remnant.
That's very nice.
Any other question? Yes.
You'll hear more about 3D simulations from Gilles Ferrand, which is indeed very computationally intensive. Thank you. This is very nice talk and work. I was curious always about fitting those types of multi-wavelength spectra with either hadronic or leptonic model. We know that in many of these remnants, including Tycho you showed earlier, there's a cloud in the northeast, for example. And so one would expect to have a hadronic model, for example, working more on one side because you have more thermal gas, more protons or gas, and therefore hadronic should dominate, and in other places, leptonic.
Yes.
So why not use a hybrid model when fitting your spectra. Is that something that you could?
Yeah, usually our model can usually focus on one particular region of a remnant. So you are correct. If there's different regions of remnant that truly clearly have different properties, we have to run two simulations. One simulation for one part and the other simulation for another part. And then we combine these two simulations together to get the true model for the remnant. And besides the purely hadronic model and leptonic model, some of the remnants have mixed contribution from hadronic and leptonic. So both inverse Compton and hadronic component can contribute almost comparatively to the gamma ray emissions.
So you do hybrid models when you fit for things like Tycho, for example?
Yeah, maybe
because
in the future.
Because like here, for example, I see either leptonic or hadronic.
For this one, we are basically focusing on the brightest part here.
Right, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I meant for other ones.
But in the future, you're absolutely correct. For example, if you want to have a model for the whole remnant, then we have to separate the remnant into several parts. Okay. And then once independent simulations.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And last question here.
Just a quick comment with regard to what Samar just said. Two things. One is that there is a significant difficulty in dealing with multi-component environments around remnants that are not resolved in gamma rays. For many of them, you only have the emission from the bulk region, and so you have to make additional gross assumptions if you want to try to do what you're saying. But an example of exactly what you're saying is a paper by Castro et al. From our group on CTV-109, where we did indeed conclude that a hybrid model was exactly what was needed. That one.
Okay, thanks very much. Let's thank Herman once again.
Thank you very much.